Hello, welcome to yet another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, currently struggling with a very bad cold here in Istanbul, as you can probably tell. In this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you're a fan, you can directly support this podcast by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that deal, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five great books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have featured on previous episodes of Turkey Book Talk. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com and help support Turkey Book Talk. Also, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, do consider supporting through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details and links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now let's get on with this latest episode, in which we welcome Alexander Clarkson. He's a lecturer of European and German Studies at King's College London, specialising in diaspora communities in Europe, including from Turkey. Alexander recently penned a very interesting long article on the Turkish and Kurdish communities in Germany, titled Kenan Evren's Bitter Harvest, The Legacies of a Coup That Changed Turkey and Europe. The piece focuses on the ripple effect of Turkey's 1980 military coup, its run-up, and its aftermath among migrants from Turkey and Germany. I've put a link up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com if you want to read that article, as I'd urge you to do, particularly considering deteriorating relations between Ankara and Berlin recently. The piece makes the case that the 1980 coup had a lasting impact that remains relevant today. In this conversation, Alexander addresses the bitter current state of ties between Germany and Turkey, the changes in Turkish and Kurdish nationalist ideology in the diaspora, the rising importance of Islamism after the coup, and the impact of Recep Tayyip Erdogan on the relationship. But I started by asking him to sketch out the situation among the Turkish diaspora community in Germany in the run-up to the 1980 coup.
Well, it's partly to do with a particular formative period in the diaspora politics of the Turkish and Kurdish communities at that period. What you had by 1980 is an extremely increasingly established and entrenched community. So Turks start arriving in significant numbers in Germany in 1960 and 1961. But at that point, throughout the 60s and early 70s, it wasn't quite clear yet whether this was going to be a permanent community or not. Because the basic assumptions of the guest worker system in the Federal Republic of Germany were based on a set of treaties between the West German government and various labor exporting states, of which Turkey was an example. So, and this was based on a shared assumption between immigrants and the receiving state, that immigration was temporary, that you were literally a guest, that your visa, your work documents, everything else was based on the notion that you were there for a temporary period of time, or 2, 3, 4 years, and then you would return home. And so particularly in the period between 1961 through to 1973, 1974, what you have is you have a certain degree of politicization in the Turkish community and Kurdish communities in Germany, but not necessarily a forms of politicization based on any sense of permanence, right? So you have the 1961 coup, that has an impact. Certainly what happens in the early 1970s has an impact on the Turkish-German community, but there's no sense that this is going to be a permanent political element in German society, and there's no sense within these communities that it's worth really expending much energy and time building up a diasporic infrastructure in Germany if the standing assumption is that everybody going through the system is going to return to Turkey at some point later. And so there's a key date before this that leads the build up to 1980 in the German context, and that's the 1973 abandonment of the guest worker system. So in 1973, you begin to see an increase in unemployment in West Germany, and you see growing pressure on the SPD government to get rid of this system, to reduce immigrant numbers, so they cancel the system. And this puts Turks and Kurds in Germany in a difficult position. They have to choose whether they're going home, or whether they're going to the country of origin, or whether they say, saying. This is a key moment in the whole life of the community that then builds up to what happens later. So you have many people opt to go back to Turkey, right? So it's not that the entire community decides we're staying here and we're going to build set up roots. But those that decide to stay permanently. So you then, in this context, you have between 1973 to 1980, a shift from sort of these temporary workers' clubs, this largely male-dominated or single women-dominated community, to a situation where people who've decided to stay permanently are bringing their families over. They're bringing their children, their wives, and they're beginning to build for the long term. And in that process, you see a shift from sort of temporary activism, rather low-level political activity, to something much more fundamental, much more extensive. So that's one of the interesting dynamics, is that the 1960s, you see this growth in Turkish and Kurdish numbers in Germany, but only after 1973 do you see a shift to the building of a long-lasting and permanent community infrastructure. And that intersects with what's happening in Turkey itself. And already in the mid-1970s to late 1970s, you're seeing growing political violence between rival Turkish-German groups and Kurdish-German groups in Germany. And you're seeing growing concern in the police and the security services that, first of all these Turks and Kurds aren't going away, because the German government assumed that killing the guest worker system would get rid of all of these people. Actually, many decide to stay, and actually their numbers increase because they're bringing their kids and their wives and their aunts and uncles and so on over. So that you have this buildup of pressure in the community that is sort of discharged, explodes in 1980 in response to the coup, because that, of course, alters all calculations in Turkey itself, but also has a massive impact on the Turkish and Kurdish German communities, as I describe in my blog post, which is I'm going to use that as a basis for a chapter in my book, because suddenly this big community in Germany becomes a matter both of concern for the Turkish state as well as a safe haven for all the different groups the Turkish state is trying to crack down on in 1980. And that again leads to a further surge in politicization and conflict within the diaspora.
And in that context, you talk about four main constituencies: the Turkish left, far-right Turkish nationalists, Islamist groups, and Kurdish nationalist networks. And all four of these groups found immigrant communities in Europe as a kind of safe haven in which to organize. But as you describe it in the post, initially the two most important of those groups were the Turkish left and the right-wing Turkish nationalists, because in many ways these already had roots in the diaspora before the 1980 coup.
Yeah.
Could you just talk a little bit about how those were the two most important constituencies before the coup occurred?
Well, it's partly to do with the kind of activism that unfolds in the 1970s. They're initially brought in the 1960s and 1970s to cover a labor shortage in industry, to cover big labor shortages within the German working class. So what you have is you have this mass importation of labor from various Turkish regions into Germany, into a particular industrial environment that intersects with two moments of left-wing radicalization, one in West Germany and one in Turkey. And of course, in West Germany, this is the moment of 1968, the moment of the student movement, which also has an impact on trade union politics in Germany. And at the same time, you're seeing a moment of radicalization in Turkey, right? Within the Gecekundu communities, you have a growing and increasingly assertive left-wing movement that's going out and trying at least to recruit people in this period of massive urbanization, massive industrialization that's taking place in Turkey. And you have this intersection, particularly since many, many of those Turks and Kurds being important in Germany have their initial moment of radicalization into left-wing politics within the Turkish urban context they're coming from. And that also has a lot to do with where Turkish Germans and Kurdish Germans were recruited from. So the Turkish Germans and Kurdish Germans coming to Germany come in three waves. They come in the early 1960s to mid-1960s. That's the first wave. And that's a wave primarily recruited from places like Izmir, Trabzon, Istanbul itself, Ankara, from places that were already urbanizing. So they're recruiting people who were already workers in Turkey, right? So those are the first people who come in, and they tend towards the left. The second wave is the mid to late 1960s, and these are people increasingly from Anatolia. So they begin to struggle to recruit people from the Turkish cities, and they're beginning to recruit people from Anatolia. And they come in to these established industrial environments, and you begin to see clashes between different kinds of Turkish milieus within German cities and within German factories. And the final wave is from East Anatolia. It's from what what you could call the Kurdish-speaking regions. And that's a final wave that comes into this already highly diverse German working environments, but also confronts established Turkish left, then established Turkish right-wing groups, and begin to define themselves against them as a space in which Kurdish nationalist groups can organize. So what you have by the mid-1970s, as these various working groups of workers realize that they're staying in Germany, as they begin to organize and create a community life to structure their lives around it, you have an environment that's actually heavily tilted towards the left initially, then towards the nationalist radical right, in which Islamists' currents are there, but they're not as dominant as people and historians often assume, looking back. Because there's a tendency to sort of look at the community as it is now and project that history backwards. Whereas in reality, what you have in the 1970s is an environment that's much more dominated by the left and then the radical right and various Kurdish groups. And this Islamization of part of the community only begins to gain momentum in the 1980s with the strong support of the Turkish state, only really after the coup of 1980. So as a result, what you have is for the Turkish left, which is to a great extent crushed in September 1980, is you have a growing environment that's very, very hospitable because all of these Turkish, you know, TKPML, RIM, Bolshevik Partizan, all of these different Turkish left-wing groups, DHKPC, they all have strong organizations and infrastructures in German with a kind of a overall organization called ATIF, a national federation within Germany, and with which they've been building and from which they've already been drawing funds. And that becomes a safe haven, which then leads to a further surge of politicization in the Turkish diaspora in Germany. And the same goes for the radical right, for the MHP. I mean, Asaprhan Türkeş is already touring Germany in 1978, 1979. He's meeting people, senior German, West German politicians like Franz Josef Strauß, right, as sort of a, through this shared notion of anti-communism. And he's trying to sell the MHP as a kind of a, and the Grey Wolves as a kind of people who can, you know, create discipline and order in German factories with, for German factory owners concerned about left-wing radicalization. And of course, in parallel to this, you have various rival Turkish organizations, not just the PKK, but also other groups like Komkar, also discovering diaspora as a space in which you can fundraise, a space in which you can recruit, and very importantly, a space in which you can find West European, German, Dutch, Belgian, French, Scandinavian allies, right? People within the left, right in, from the SPD, right through the radical left in Western Europe, who can help lobby for your cause. Right, and the PKK becomes very, very good at building a highly effective lobby within the West European left over the course of the 1980s. So, you know, they're already discovering this world. They're already discovering the benefits of having this kind of diaspora structure. So when the coup happens in September 1980, it's natural for them to flee to Western Europe, to flee to West Germany, and build on these kinds of bases as a space in which you can have a safe haven and organize and try to re-infiltrate Turkish society. Not particularly successfully in the case of the Turkish left, a little bit more successfully in the case of the MHP, but certainly very successfully in the case of the PKK as the insurgency begins to gain momentum in Turkey itself.
One of the really interesting things is the fact that the conflicts within the Turkish diaspora in Germany really do mirror the conflicts in Turkey. So in the 1970s, before the coup, you've got this very violent set of clashes between various left-wing groups and right-wing groups. And in the end, that kind of precipitates a coup in Turkey to restore order. And then in the aftermath of the coup, the left is brutally cracked down on, and the right, it's after the 1980 coup that Islamism really emerges. It was always there in the 70s before, but it wasn't until after the coup that Islamism emerged as a really potent force. And of course, Kurdish nationalism became radicalized with the declaration of the insurgency, the PKK's insurgency in 1983. So it's funny, like, I was really struck as I was reading the post about how closely the conflicts in Germany kind of mirrored the stuff going on back in Turkey.
But it's also a sign of the extent to which you have, this isn't so much a process of migration as a process of constant circulation. And I think this is one of the problems in the way in which Turkish migration, Kurdish migration, you know, all the other countries that I work on extensively, which is, of course, you know, the former Yugoslav republics, Ukraine, North Africa, we tend to use, or colleagues tend to use, a kind of United States model of what's taking place. Like this notion that people move, say, from a distant land, they arrive in the States, and they stay entrenched in the States, and they have only very brief contact with their countries of origin. That is not what's happening in Germany. In Germany, you have a constant circulation of people who go back to Turkey in the holidays, who go on a visit. Plane travel over the crisis of the 1980s becomes easier. I mean, anybody who grew up in Germany in the 1980s and the 1990s will be very familiar with the massive traffic jams at the Austrian and then at the Hungarian border, as literally tens and hundreds of thousands of people from guest worker families go to their home regions for the holidays. So, you know, in that context, there's no kind of clear separation between Turkish and German politics. Both are actually become increasingly intertwined, particularly because on an urban level in Germany, Turks and Kurdish groups are increasingly financially and politically powerful. I think this is also the second problem I have with a lot of discussion of the Turkish and Kurdish communities, both from the left, both from people who are very supportive of new models of integration, and also from the right. They're often portrayed as who are hostile to integration. Turkish and Kurdish Germans are portrayed as a kind of a separate group. There's this terrible term, very common in migration studies or migration history, called ghettoization, right? The notion that these are isolated communities, they cut off from the wider mainstream society, and either they have to be removed entirely, that's the right-wing position, or the left-wing position, they have to be saved. So some German activists or politicians come out and say, we will help you and we will integrate you through us. Whereas in reality, Turkish and Kurdish communities are heavily integrated, intertwined in urban and local politics in Germany. To this day, I mean, any politician in Berlin who tries to do anything against the will of key Kurdish groups gets in trouble, right? They're very powerful, very effective. They have a growing number of voters, right? And they deploy this influence quite very, very systematically to lobby for their own cause. So in terms of Kurdish and Turkish German migration, what you end up with, or circulation, is a erosion of the border between foreign and domestic policy in Germany. Turkish politics is domestic German politics, because everything that happens in Turkey has immediate knock-on effects on German society. And I would actually argue, although I'd be very interested to hear my colleagues who work on the other end of this, that I suspect that everything that happens in Germany has immediate knock-on effects with Turkish society. So, for example, if you have colleagues you know who work on the relations between the United States and Turkey, that's a very much a foreign policy dynamic between both. Whereas in the German-Turkish case, this is an intertwining of foreign domestic policy. The borderline between the two and relations between both societies is actually quite unclear. And in that context, particularly now, the Turkish and Kurdish communities play a significant role, very much at the heart of German politics, but not necessarily a united role, right? In the Turkish case, Turkish-German case, you have four or five separate milieus, each with their own particular relationships with various German political parties, each with their own political leaders, each with their own prominent figures in German society, all pushing for rival and different and often conflicting approaches towards German society. So that's my third and final beef, is this notion that the Turkish Germans are a homogeneous group. They are anything but. And you can quite clearly see that in the responses to how Erdogan has discussed and engaged with the German government over the last two or three years.
Now, one of the things that happened in the 1980s is that Kurdish nationalism really took hold, both in Turkey and in Europe. There was a lot more organizing. And part of that whole process was that the PKK basically eliminated all kinds of rival groups to become the kind of sole, or try to achieve hegemony over this Kurdish nationalist movement. And again, that's something that mirrored what happened in Turkey, because, you know, there were various rival groups and it basically eliminated them. And it did something very similar, according to your account, in Germany.
It's systematic. I mean, if you go into I've been very, very lucky in being given extensive access to police and security service files on a regional level as well as a national level. I mean, there's a tremendous treasure trove of information, for example, in the German Foreign Office, which has all the domestic files, because whenever there was an incident, they had to consult with the people who had the expertise. So the German Auswärtiges Amt often constantly got data from various regional police forces and regional presses. And one of those, you know, you get all these different files, and often the hugest files are criminal cases involving the PKK and involving the PKK's systematic moves, particularly between about 1983 right through to 1991, to effectively spy out and physically eliminate, i.e. kill or severely wound or force out of politics their enemies in the Kurdish community. And you can really clearly see this as a process of community consolidation that works. It's successful. I mean, particularly the case of Komkar, which is a sort of more slightly differently structured organization, which is, their meetings are constantly assaulted and attacked by PKK activists. And yet what's fascinating is the extent to which the West German left largely ignores this. It largely engages and accepts the PKK's narrative of the insurgency in Turkey. And to the extent to which rival groups to the PKK within the Kurdish community give up in despair by about 1991 and 1992, and simply just effectively abandon attempts to engage with the West German center-left and left, because the PKK proves so effective in presenting its struggle as a struggle of martyrdom. And what the PKK is also very, very good at is finding a political language that matches the language of the West German left, or the after 1990 of the German left. So there's this propaganda material, there's documentation that constantly compares the PKK struggle with struggles and political instances that are deeply familiar to the West German or the German left in 1990. So there's references to National Socialism, references to fascism. I mean, the various figures running the PKK operation in Germany are very, very well attuned to the structure and the particular language of German left-wing discourse in a way in which their rival organizations weren't. So again, it's the PKK runs at all levels a process to gain hegemony over the Kurdish community in Germany, and they do it successfully, and they do it with the partial, witting or unwitting is still one of the things I'm still trying to work out, but with the support of the West German left that see the PKK as this kind of revolutionary, transformative organization, able to do things that the West parts of the West German left wish they could do within German society. It's also based on a German misreading of what the PKK is and how it's ideologically structured. And again, this is a legacy you can see to this day. So the PKK that I experienced in the 1990s, and I grew up in Germany in the late 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, and you know, the PKK was something that you encountered if you were like a young, spotty teenager getting engaged in left-wing politics. You know, they were something you encountered on the street in mass protest. There was always this PKK presence. And the PKK became extremely effective at presenting its case, not just on an abstract level, but on an everyday level. But what has also fascinated me is to watch the transformation of the PKK in the diaspora. So the PKK you encountered in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a thuggish component to it. There were people who very shrewdly knew how to appeal to the West German left, but much of it seemed still very roughly hewn in a kind of guerrilla self-image. If you deal with representatives of front organizations of the PKK today, it's like watching a smooth DC lobbyist, right? They show up in suits, they are supported or engaged with through people who are lawyers and academics in the mainstream of German society. They're extremely effective and professional at presenting their case. So, you know, it's an interesting contrast. You have this disunity within the Turkish community of very various rival groups making their case. In the Kurdish community, the PKK gains hegemony, but also becomes a very professional organization in West European terms.
And the other really striking thing that came through in the piece was the fact that, again, this idea of mirroring in that, as you describe it, Islamist networks in Germany, there was a kind of tolerance and even encouragement for them among local authorities. And obviously you can draw parallels with what was going on in Turkey with the post-coup governments and the, you know, famous Turkish Islamic synthesis that was pushed.
Yeah.
And as you describe it, you know, these Islamist networks in Germany kind of set up various education and religious services. And I don't know, I was just very struck reading again how this kind of mirrored a process that was going on back in Turkey.
Well, as what's interesting is it's not just, this isn't just something that's happening with the Turkish community. I mean, in my first book, I mean, this blog post was a sort of a trial balloon for ideas that are going into my book that I'm completing by March. But in my first book, I looked at these processes in the Ukrainian community, in the Greek community, Spanish community, the Iranian community, and you can see something quite clearly over the course of the Cold War. That in the Cold War, a whole set of assumptions about how to handle immigrant communities is very different from assumptions that you would find after 1990 or 1991. Particularly in the 60s through to the 1980s, Islamist groups, religious groups are considered safer. They're still considered problematic, and there's still a degree of latent hostility towards them, but they're considered safer than the left. And they're also considered safer than the MHP, because the MHP reminds many Germans, particularly Germans of the center-left, of various National Socialist precedents. So, you know, when it comes down to it, for a German local official or a German local police official, they would rather have a Diyanet affiliated organization dealing and handling the local Turkish community, or acting as an intermediary for the local Turkish community, then they would have somebody who came from the TKPML, right, in the 1970s and 1980s, quite clearly. And there's a lot of fear and moves against left-wing alternatives and left-wing organizations. Now, this begins to shift the 1980s, particularly since the great bulk of Islamist work in Germany does reflect the Turkish Islamic synthesis. But of course, the Turkish German community isn't operating in a vacuum. It's exposed to what's happening in various Arab communities. It's exposed to growing interest in what's happening in Afghanistan. And, you know, there's a radical organization in Cologne, the Kaplan Group, which, you know, goes way off the reservation and scares the living daylights both out of the Turkish and the German governments. But, you know, really throughout the 1980s, these Islamist organizations promoted by Turkish diplomats. And remember, every major German city has a Turkish consulate. This is also, I mean, there's a huge Turkish diplomatic presence in Germany to this day. There's a consulate in my hometown in Hannover, and there's consulates in Hamburg and Bremen and Köln, even Dortmund and smaller industrial cities. And each of these consulates provides a node for the Turkish intelligence services, provides a node for Diyanet, which can then help support the reconstruction of mosques and the reconstruction of religious infrastructure that reflects the concerns of the Turkish government and the way in which, you know, Kenan Evren's government is trying to reshape Islamism within Germany itself. And of course, what the German government and West German government and, of course, the Turkish government of the 1980s can't anticipate is the possibility that the AKP, a party like the AKP, would take over this infrastructure and reorient it towards a much more clearly state-backed Islamist agenda. But in a sense, what all of these institutions and developments and frameworks that scare the living dickens out of the German government today, because they have been captured by the AKP and used to promote a particular AKP agenda, they were established and nurtured with the help of the German government through the Turkish organizations like Diyanet in the 1980s. And there's the term blowback. There is a kind of a blowback dynamic that you can see now over the 30 or 40 year evolution of these various Islamic organizations initially set up very much with the support of the Evren government.
One of the other things you talk about is about how it was around the aftermath of the coup that the Turkish National Intelligence Agency, or MIT, started becoming much more active in Europe, particularly in West Germany. And today, of course, that's also very salient because there's a lot of reports of Turkish intelligence work in Europe, including various abductions of suspected Gulenists and PKK members and general dissidents. Could you just talk a bit about the MIT's work in Europe, both in the 1980s and today?
Well, what, of course, in many ways, what you have in 1980, September 1980, is a moment where MIT suddenly has a clear hierarchy above it, giving it clear orders. So what you have in the 1970s is you have all of this confusion at the state level. So the MIT is already concerned about what's happening in Germany, but it's getting no clear orders as to what to do next. It's really right after September 1980, it's getting clear instructions by a Turkish government, very concerned, by a Turkish junta military network, very concerned about what's happening in Germany, to go out and bring these things under control. So, of course, you have Diyanet, which is the carrot. You know, here we can help you build these mosques and give you funding and educate your kids and create all these incentives to be part of a loyal organization loyal to the Turkish state. And then there's the stick. MIT agents start showing up in much greater numbers in Germany after September 1980 to really try to put fear into groups and organizations that are seen as hostile to the Turkish state. I mean, there is an ongoing battle between PKK and MIT operatives in German streets, which drives the West German police and security services completely round the twist. I mean, this dysfunctional relationship, I mean, the most dysfunctional relationship in NATO between intelligence services is between the German and the Turkish intelligence services. But that's nothing new, right? All the same complaints you'll hear from contacts today, you can read in the archives from the 1980s. Here are MIT people on our patch. They just shot someone. Why are they doing this? They didn't consult us. They're kidnapping people, leftists, they're intimidating people, it's really embarrassing. There's a constant stream of just moaning and frustration from West German intelligence officials about these MIT operatives that are, on the one hand, crossing a whole set of red lines for the West German government, and yet at the same time are a NATO ally, so you can't really attack them frontally. You can't really come out and say, you know, we're going to arrest you if you cross this line. I mean, if you look at the language of the German intelligence services today, this is not just about Erdogan. This is about 30 or 40 years of profound frustration with what they see as the MIT's just arrogance in dealing with these Turkish German communities. I think what gives the West German intelligence services, or the German intelligence services more confidence to say this today, is that also actually you have more and more parts of the Turkish German community that, because they were once leftist, would have been hostile to cooperate with the German government and state. But because these leftist milieus are actually those milieus that have integrated most deeply into German society, many critics of the current West Turkish government and many critics of the Turkish intelligence services are much more willing to cooperate with German authorities now than they would have been 30 or 40 years ago. You even have people whose parents belong to these ultra-left-wing Turkish milieus now serving in the German intelligence services, which of course also affects the way the German intelligence services view the MIT in the way compared to where in the 1980s. But again, this isn't anything new. This has been happening year on year for years and years and years. And I think something has also snapped within the German intelligence community when it comes to dealing with their Turkish colleagues.
Hmm. And also, you mentioned a little bit there the control that the Diyanet, the Director of Religious Affairs, has over so many mosques in Europe. And it's obviously become a point of contention between Turkey and a lot of governments. But one thing that's not so often mentioned, I don't think, is the fact that many security officials in Europe have commented on these kind of mosques and almost praised them, really, as a proven buffer against more radical mosques that have fostered sympathy for ISIS and whatnot. I don't know if you could just comment about that and how the genesis of like Diyanet linked mosques again in the aftermath of the 1980 coup kind of took off in places like West Germany.
So in September 1980, I mean, the coup takes place. You already have attempts by Diyanet-linked organizations to assert themselves in Germany. But it's really, you have the coup in 1980, and then you have a very concerted effort by the Turkish states to reorder the religious landscape in Germany, the Islamic religious landscape in Germany. So you have the foundation of DİTİB, which is a kind of a Diyanet-affiliate association in Germany, which acts as the kind of main buffer between Diyanet and the German state. And that reorganization and establishment of DİTİB is in the years after the coup. So you also have an expansion, you have greater funding for these organizations. And it's also not just a legacy of 1980, it's a legacy of 1973. You have the Turkish government also acknowledging and realizing that it will have millions of its citizens in Germany indefinitely, but these citizens aren't coming back. Also, this is also linked with a rise in demand. So you have a growing number of Turkish-German children, and that also begins to really grip the community only in the late 70s and early 80s. So you have a mixture of demand, a mixture of acceptance that this is going to be a permanent community, and you have this flash of politicization in September, you know, really driven in the build-up to September in 1980 and afterwards. That means that the Turkish government is reorganizing this network. Initially, it's actually to create an acceptable alternative to the left, right? So if the documentation of the 1980s, it's all about how a proper religious organization can keep all these Turks now living in your society away from all these evil Bolshevik leftist groups. In the 1990s, the Diyanet as an organization markets itself is the organization that can keep Turks in Germany moderate. And this is under Özal and Demirel and Schiller, right? This precedes the AKP, this language of we can keep these people disciplined and on the right side for you. But this idea of Diyanet and the AKP itself and its organizations in Germany itself, particularly Milli Görüş, which initially is treated with a lot of suspicion, but increasingly merges into Diyanet-linked organizations as the AKP rises to power in Germany. In Turkey,
not yet.
God help us. But in the end, what happens at this point is, particularly between 2000 and 2008, enormous amount of optimism and hope is projected into the AKP, not just by the German government, but by many German intellectuals, by many Turkish German leftists, and people who were like the sons and daughters of the Turkish German left that had settled over the course of the 1980s and 1990s. There was a lot of, in a sense, people, the West Turkish German community, as well as the German establishment, bought into the myth of the AKP as a moderating force far more so than anybody in Turkey, or arguably the United States, because two forms of hope got bound up in all of this. There was the hope that the AKP could provide an alternative to radicalism within the Islamic world, but also in Germany, there was a profound hope that the AKP was basically another version, a sort of a Ottomanized Christian democracy, right? So the amount of panels and events I remember from 2004 to 2008 where where you'd go, and you'd have CDU Konrad Adenauer Stiftung figures saying, the AKP, Erdogan might be the next Adenauer. So there's a tremendous act of projection. And it's partly by the German establishment, it's partly by Turkish Germans, who have this hope that the AKP won't just act as a moderating, integrating force for Turkey into Europe, but also that it would act as a moderating and integrating force for Turkish Germans in German society, right? So there's all this optimism driven by a misreading of what's happened in Turkey that also means that Diyanet and all these organizations are held up as this alternative to radicalization, which again, on a street level, means that the AKP is given enormous leeway to simply put whoever it likes within this wider organization. Interestingly enough, to the frustration of a lot of people in Milli Görüs, who thought they would be taking over and that they thought they would have more control, but they're not entirely, the local, you know, cadres aren't entirely trusted by the AKP in Turkey itself, but also increasingly to the frustration of many people in the Turkish German community interested in you know, expressing their Islamic faith. I mean, they don't like particularly like the politicization that is taking place. But this is largely glossed over because the AKP is held up as the sort of moderating force. And it is quite remarkable how many people compared Erdogan to Adenauer in the 2000s Germany. It seems absurd looking back now.
And bringing the issue up to the present day, we're speaking just before the election in Germany, but this podcast will be published after that election. And one of the big themes in the run up to this election has been the really bitter tension really between Turkey and Germany on a whole host of questions. Yeah. And at one point, of course, Erdogan called on Turkish origin German citizens to not vote for any of the major parties and calling them enemies of Turkey, which was a typically measured and sane intervention. I mean, do you think this is a temporary problem, or do you think it signals something deeper and more long-term?
I think it's deep and long-term in three ways, and I think it's important to start with the Turkish-Germany community itself. I think whoever is advising Erdogan, you get the impression that the top echelons of the AKP are convinced that Turkish Germans are still primarily Turkish in the way people in Turkey are Turkish, and that's a profound misreading of this community. This community, it's enormous. I mean, anywhere between 2.4 to 2.9 million people, depending on how you classify a person as Turkish German. That's more than many EU states. It's a highly politically and ideologically diverse community. It's a community in which, ironically, the left is much stronger than in Turkey itself, because the left was able to survive and build its organizations. And the left has become a kind of the milieu that integrated far more into German society. And so what it's done as a first point is it's divided the Turkish-German community amongst itself. There are all kinds of fault lines of polarization in German society when it comes to the Turkish issue, but one of the main ones is between Turkish Germans. And you could clearly see this in the referendum result. There is this very false figure thrown around that 60% of Turkish Germans supported the AKP. In reality, only of 2.9 million people, only 1.5 million were eligible to vote. Only 700,000 voted, and of that 700,000, 400,000 voted AKP, and 294,000 voted against. So you have all of these kinds of fissures. So among politicized Turkish Germans, quite clearly there's a high degree of polarization that Erdogan's promoting, and he's worsening this. He's alienating significant numbers of the Turkish German community from Turkey, right? So he's coming in and saying he's trying to alienate Turkish Germans from Germany and presented himself as the protector of Turkish Germans. In reality, he's actually putting more and more Turkish Germans off the Turkish state among the half of the community that's hostile to him, that's politicized. Among the half of the community that's loyal to him, I think it's very difficult to estimate how deep that loyalty goes. How far are people willing to sacrifice for the Turkish state? And again, I think there as a second point, I think there's a limit to the extent to which Erdogan can mobilize people for himself. I think he might actually be overplaying his hand among his own parts of his loyalist community, among the loyalist community. There's a very important organization called the UETD. That's the Union of European Turkish Democrats. That's the AKP's affiliate in Germany now. And whereas, you know, they can sort of bring people out for major political events and protests, actually, in comparison to the actual size of the community, it's a very limited number of people often bust in. So the second issue that's raised is whether Erdogan, by mobilizing those elements of the community that support him now, is actually overplaying his hand and actually beginning to create a process where this particular part of the community becomes less engaged in politics because it becomes less productive, more problematic in terms of relations with the German state. And actually, Erdogan is trying to get them to do too much for too little outcome. You know, if you're a conservative Turkish German, at some point you're going to ask yourself, and I think you're already seeing this in the community, you know, okay, so we've gone out in the streets for the Turkish government. What actually is it doing for us? How is it going to improve our position? And if on the German streets, the UETD and the DNA and AKP can't really produce more results directly in negotiation with the German state because of this adversarial relationship, then I think there's growing questions about how far they can retain that support. And finally, I think it also reflects an extent to which the attitudes of the German state towards its Turkish-German citizens has been transformed. Because one of the main points of conflict between the Turkish government and the German state has been the way the Turkish government has arrested or mistreated Turkish Germans who are citizens of the German Federal Republic. Right. So you have Jenny Zutel, right, who Antolu and a whole bunch of German journalists, Turkish German journalists, who've been arrested. And I think there was a miscalculation by the Turkish state. The Turkish state assumed that because these people were ethnically Turkish, the German government wouldn't care. But what we have seen is a massive sea change in the attitude of the German state. Maybe a decade or two ago, the German state would have been much more cagey about protecting people who weren't ethnically German. But under this current government, it's quite clear that the German government, the German security services, the German police, German political parties see Turkish German citizens as citizens of the country, as equals. So I think very much the surprise of the AKP when it started arresting all of these Turkish Germans who were citizens of the German Federal Republic, the German government came in and said, "You are arresting our citizens and this is a huge problem." I think that's very, very interesting because I think that's as a final factor. I think it shows the extent to which the Turkish government has misread big social shifts in German society towards its immigrant origin population, towards diaspora populations, from a situation in the 1980s and 1990s where even if you were a citizen, you were still seen as somebody outside of the folk, outside of the national community, to a situation in 2017 where the German government very much, and most mainstream German political parties, very much see immigrants as a central part of German society. And if you have that passport, you are a German, and we will defend you, right? So I think that's also a very, very interesting sign. And it shows the extent to which the politics of both countries are intertwined on one level, but also the extent to which the political elites of both countries keep misreading one another. And that's the worst possible dynamic, where both countries are deeply interlinked, but the elites of both countries keep misreading each other's behavior and keep doing things that provoke the other side.
And what about this new party that's been set up in Germany that's organically linked to the AKP? And I think it first took part in local elections last year. I mean, what do you make of this new initiative from the AKP, really, in Germany?
I mean, you know, every once in a while, some organization tries to set up a party based on the Turkish political system. And there was another party called the BIG, the so-called big party, and that was a failure. It's actually in some ways electorally mystifying the great number of people who supported the AKP, many of them are either purely Turkish citizens or don't necessarily vote in German elections. So you have this weird dichotomy in terms of electoral behavior, in that you have a lot of Turkish Germans who are German citizens, and they'll go out from vote for parties of the center left, and they won't go out, for example, if they have the Turkish passport and vote in Turkish electoral processes. It's pretty certain that this party the AKP has set up is going to fail electorally. I mean, there is simply no constituency there that's going to go out and vote for it in any great number. So it's a little bit mystifying. Anybody in a Turkish consul, any smart Turkish diplomat, if they still have a will to keep their job, would have told this to the AKP. And I suspect the AKP's organization, the UETD, is very well aware of this. The only rational explanation I have for this is that it's a way of ensuring that the German government cannot ban affiliated organizations to the AKP. Because until now, the UETD was, in German law, it was an eingetragener Verein. That's a registered association, and it's quite easy actually legally for the German government to deem an association like a football club or a cultural club or whatever to deem it as a risk to the constitution and get rid of it. Right? There are very few legal barriers to going, or fewer legal barriers to going through this process. Under German law, it's very, very difficult to ban a political party. I mean, the NPD, which is a clearly neo-Nazi party, is still around because it's so difficult to ban political parties because of the course National Socialist presidents. So the only rational explanation I can find for this move is just to make sure that if you have a registered political party, you can keep your infrastructure going and avoid it from getting banned by an irate German state after you've done something provocative again. The only other explanation, of course, is that this is some sort of ego trip.
And that party is called the Alliance of German Democrats, the ADD.
Yeah, yes.
I saw some fantastic posters of Erdogan, like on these provincial German streets, you know, with his picture emblazoned on these street billboards advertising this party.
Yeah, it's. I think it's often just below the AFD posters, right? The radical, the National Conservative Party. And the absurd thing is that there is a joke party of the 1990s called the APP Day, which is the Semiantische the Pogo-Partei Deutschlands, which was a punk party, which where they used to give free beer to leftist activists. So this thing the AKP has set up sounds a lot. Its acronym is very close to this old joke party. I mean, again, it shows how cack-handed a move this was. Because they just aren't reading the electoral landscape properly, and it also to me shows the extent to which whoever made this decision doesn't actually understand the Turkish-German community itself, right? So my only rational explanation is this is a legal move to protect the AKP structure from being banned or shut down by the German state. But it's entirely possible this is just a sort of egomaniac move to flatter the vanity of the AKP's leadership, who believe that they are the guardians of Turks across Europe. Whereas in reality, a lot of what they're doing is alienating significant parts of the Turkish German community from its own state, from its state of its country of origin. I mean,
and just to conclude, I mean, to compare the present day or an aspect of the present day with the situation after the 1980 coup, it's become clear that in recent years, and particularly actually after the failed coup attempt last July, that Germany's become this kind of port of call for many dissidents.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about Gulenists here, but there are, you know, all kinds of prominent journalists who have set up shop in Germany. And one thing that's been very noticeable in Turkey is that this has kind of really left them exposed to accusations from the government of basically being in the pocket of the German government and basically committing treason against Turkey. I just wonder if you could just comment on this kind of aspect, how this overseas or Germany-based dissident trend kind of compares with the situation after the 1980 coup.
Well, I think I've been talking a lot about continuities, but that's a very interesting contrast. So, you know, after September 1980, the Evren government, I mean, it was facing a very, very vulnerable political moment. There was, it was the West German government was led by the Social Democrats, by the SPD, which had very close links with Bülent Ecevit. You know, even Bülent Ecevit never went to Germany afterwards, but after the coup, but he was actually offered a professorship by the Hamburg University, which is a city governed by the SPD, which he declined. So in September 1980, you have on the one hand, you have on a covert level and on an institutional level, you have the Turkish state working together with this West German state to build these DNet structures. I mean, Kenan Evren even goes on West German television, on ZDF, which is sort of the BBC2 or PBS of Germany. He gets a half an hour slot to do a speech to the Turkish German population on a Sunday afternoon to explain what's happening, to ask them to obey West German laws. And this is partly because in 1980, in a Cold War environment, the Turkish state has an incentive to cooperate with the West German government. The West German government wants to work with the Turkish state to stabilize the situation. Also because the Turkish state is financially dependent on things like the 800 million Deutschmarks a year it was getting from the German government. If that money wasn't coming, the so-called Türkeihilfe, Turkish aid, the Evren government would have been potentially in a lot of trouble. And that's the contrast to now. So you have all these leftists fleeing to Germany, right? And then Islamists and particularly also MHP activists. And the Turkish government gets irate about this, but they do not go public because they do not want to alienate a German government they want to keep on side. That's the huge difference between Evren and Erdogan is Erdogan doesn't care, right? For Erdogan, the German government is a useful scapegoat. For Erdogan, also the German government, I think, is also a domestic political problem in that whereas the US, for many Turks, is an abstract entity. It's this thing in the distance. You can portray it or demonize it or whatever. Germany is part of everyday life for many Turks. Right, it's a place in which you have family or cousins. It's a place in which you visited family. It's a place which you can access relatively easily. It's a place whose companies you work for, whose products you're exposed to, whose football teams your football teams play against. So the German government is actually, in terms of its very existence, the way it operates, the way it's intertwined with various Turkish communities, I think also a structural problem for Erdogan. So he's opted for trying to demonize it much more systematically and turn it into a scapegoat, even though the Turkish government, it has a whole set of mutual dependencies because of the big role of the German business in the Turkish economy. So I think the huge contrast is that in this context, because Erdogan has built up this sort of anti-Western and anti-German government stance over the last few years, that's a huge contrast to 1980. So you're not just criticizing these individual dissidents; you're claiming that the German government is culpable in protecting the PKK and protecting all these dissidents and being part of this grand plot against the Turkish state. Yet again, this is different different from the way in which you handle the US. Germany plays a much more fundamental role in Turkish society on a street and everyday level. So in that context, whether Erdogan using the German government as a scapegoat is going to be really effective, or whether it doesn't create a whole set of underlying risks that the Turkish state or his government can't bear is, I think, an interesting question. But yeah, that is the huge contrast with what you saw in 1980. And we have to see how that affects the migration deal, how that affects business links, how that affects a whole set of social ties. Because, I mean, I personally have never seen the relations between the Turkish government and the German government at this kind of low. I think that for me, it's actually genuinely, I can understand the assertiveness of the German government, but I find the level to which Erdogan is willing to actually do potential damage to himself and his own government by offending Turkey's closest political and economic partner, I find that genuinely surprising.
That was Alexander Clarkson. Many thanks to him. As I said before, I've put a link up to his very interesting article that we were discussing at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can support the podcast and get a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available, visit the special page created for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support the podcast is via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters: Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jean-Marcus Vermo, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, and Paul Levin. Also, please do rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which really does help increase awareness of it for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until our next episode in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Seçtiğim sensin bütün dünyayı.